Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point, January 1st, 1863. Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, America's great break with slavery. January 2009, African-American Barack Obama will lay his hand on Lincoln's Bible to take his oath as President of the United States. It's a good moment to look back on history. This hour, On Point, the Emancipation Proclamation and its resonance today. Joining us today from Washington, D.C. is Edna Green Medford, Associate Professor of History at Howard University. She specializes in 19th century African American history. She's co-author of The Emancipation Proclamation, Three Views, along with Harold Holzer and Frank Williams of Rhode Island. Edna Green Medford, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you today?
Wonderful. Happy New Year, and thanks for being here.
Same to you.
You're quite welcome. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, who's written deeply about 19th century American history himself, most recently in his book Age of Betrayal. Jack, Happy New Year, and thank you for joining us.
Happy New Year, Tom, and how do you do, Professor Medford?
Hello, how are you today?
Professor, take us back, 1863, January 1st, 4 million or so American men, women, and children, African Americans, in slavery at that time. What did the Emancipation Proclamation mean and not mean for them on that day?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it depends on whether you're talking about how the slaves viewed it or how other people viewed it. Certainly, the slaves viewed it not just as a release from their bondage, mm-hmm. but also as an opportunity for true freedom, for full inclusion in American society. They assumed that when they were no longer considered property, they would be considered Americans, entitled to the same rights as other Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an extraordinary time for them, for both of those reasons.
Jack Beatty, across the South, as the word trickled out, many had to wait for Union forces to arrive to enforce it, but many didn't. Many just bolted.
They had bolted, and that's really how emancipation began. As W.E.B. Du Bois pointed out, it began, Lincoln was following African Americans as they left the plantations and moved across rebel lines into Union encampments, and became an embarrassment for the administration, an embarrassment because what were you to do with them? Were you to send them back? Well, couldn't do that. If you keep them, did you have the authority to keep them? And what would be the effect of keeping them free on the border states, which were equivocally in the Union and on which Lincoln depended? So the politics of it all was very complicated for him. But at the moment when freedom came, there are some wonderful memories of that. And Colonel Higginson of Boston, who later went on to found the Boston Symphony Orchestra, was on a South Carolina island drilling black volunteers when on January 1, and he read out Lincoln's order proclaiming them, quote, henceforth and forever free. And he wrote, as soon as the speaker, someone else was reading it, ceased, and just as I took and waved the flag, Higginson recalled, there suddenly arose close beside the platform a strong male voice into which two women's voices instantly blended. I never saw anything so electric. It made all the other words seem cheap. It seemed the choked voice of a race at last unloosed. They sang, my country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty.
Wow. From that day, that January 1st, Edna Green Medford, how did slaves learn about it? How did it actually happen? In that case, it was a Union officer reading it out off the South Carolina coast, the Carolina coast, but more mm-hmm. generally, how did the news spread?
Well, there were a variety of ways. Certainly enslaved people, some enslaved people would have heard actually from their owners or eavesdropping on their owner's conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, they had expected that Lincoln would do something early on, and that's why they were running from the Confederacy, you know, at the first opportunity, as soon as the war started. They understood that it was a war, they felt it was a war that would give them the opportunity for freedom. Even though Lincoln and the Union had not come to that conclusion, African Americans had. And so when he actually issues the proclamation, they hear about it through the grapevine, through the slave grapevine. Mm-hmm. They're listening at windows and doors as their owners talk about it. They're getting information from newspapers. Some of them were able to read and, mm-hmm. and actually transmitted the news of emancipation to other enslaved people. I remembered reading a slave narrative once where a man was talking about how he learned about freedom. And he said he learned while he was in a slave pen waiting to be transported out of state mm-hmm. And where he would be sold to someone else. Mm-hmm. And so someone found out about it, actually read a paper to the rest of the enslaved people wow. assembled. They ended up being sold anyway, of course, because they mm-hmm. were in the Confederacy. The interesting thing is that Lincoln was only able to touch slavery in those areas still in rebellion because of the constraints of the Constitution. But African Americans found out very quickly, most did, and even in those areas where they were not freed by the proclamation, they still had hope that their freedom was coming as well.
Can you remind us exactly who the Emancipation Proclamation applied to on that January 1st in 1863? Who was covered, who wasn't, and why?
Mm-hmm. The proclamation applied to those enslaved people still in the states in rebellion and parts thereof. There were areas of Virginia, for instance, that were not included in the proclamation because the Union already had control of that area. There were certain parishes in Louisiana that were not included. Tennessee was not included. And, of course, the four border states, Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri, were not included because they were still a part of the Union. Lincoln was only able to issue an emancipating order for those enslaved people that were still under Confederate control.
And why was that? This was an order made as commander-in-chief, not an act of Congress, but an
absolutely.
Executive commander-in-chief order. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't he free the slaves that were, you know essentially, well, either under Union control in further north or in those border states closer to Union forces?
He couldn't do that because they were property. And the Constitution does protect the right of people in terms of possession of their property. He was only able to touch slavery in the Confederate states, so those areas still in rebellion, because they were in rebellion. He used the War Powers Act of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And only in doing that, you know, was he able to issue an order to free anyone. And he wasn't even certain that that decree was going to hold up. In a court of law. He was very much concerned about the constitutionality of it. And that's one of the reasons why the 13th Amendment was necessary. Of course, it was necessary as well, because even though you have the Emancipation Proclamation saying that those folk who are still in the states in rebellion are free, there was no reason why, really, Southerners could not, after the war, start enslaving other people. So you had to make certain that slavery could not exist forever in the country, except, of course, in terms of incarceration for crime.
Of course, that didn't happen until the 13th Amendment came in. But, Jack mm-hmm. Beattie, here's something very, very telling about this time, that even Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, as Professor Ed Green Medford describes it, you know, was putting property above humanity. He couldn't free them because they were property?
He didn't have the authority, and he was criticized for that. The London Times called this hypocritical. It said, well, you know, he frees the slaves where he has no power and leaves them in slavery where he has power. But that was and became quickly, I think, a minority opinion as the implications of emancipation took hold. And the implications were clear. As Lincoln told the border state congressman earlier that year, the signs of the times are clear, and the signs of the times pointed toward freedom. You know, that morning in Washington, as James McPherson beautifully tells in his recent book on Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief, Lincoln had spent the morning shaking hands with people. It was New Year's Day, and his hand was sore from this. And he picked up the pen to sign the emancipation, but his hand was trembling. And he said, if I sign it now, quote, all who examine the document hereafter will say he hesitated. He said, I won't sign it until my hand is still. He said, I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than in signing this paper. If my name ever goes into history, it'll be for this, and my whole soul is in it. Again, he picked up the pen. Still, his hand was shaking, and he waited, and he waited. Finally, it came. He signed it, and he said, that will do.
Wow. And in just a few days, in this month, Barack Obama will use to take his oath of office on Inauguration Day Abraham Lincoln's Bible from his first inauguration in 1861. We're talking today about the Emancipation Proclamation formally signed by that hand no longer shaking, I guess, on January 1st, 1863. Edna Green Medford is with us from Howard University, co-author of the Emancipation Proclamation, Three Views. Jack Beatty's here. Professor Jack, please stand by. We'll go out with Paul Robeson singing Go Down Moses. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Spake the Lord above Moses, said, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people go.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863, it was signed, and its resonance in January 2009 as the country prepares for the inauguration of Barack Obama. Edna Green Medford is with us from Washington, expert on 19th century African American history, professor at Howard University, co-author of the Emancipation Proclamation, Three Views. Jack Beatty's here as well. What did you learn in school, at home, about the Emancipation Proclamation? Was this a noble act, a political act, a military expedient, all of the above? And when Barack Obama puts his hand on Lincoln's Bible to take the oath of office, is the circle somehow complete? Edna Green Medford, there's a ritual that I really didn't know about, but was just reading, that dates back to the night before the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. That would be the last New Year's Eve, 1862, of African Americans gathering in churches for Watch Night or Freedom's Eve to, in that first instance, pray for the signing to be completed the next day, and even unto this year, this most recent New Year's Eve, to pray at midnight on the eve of the anniversary of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. Have you ever been to one of these services, Professor?
No, I have not, but certainly they were very important to those African Americans who were enslaved, and the whole celebration observance was important to African Americans for years after that, because there was a fear that Lincoln might rescind the decree. Of course, he had issued the preliminary proclamation in September of 1862, and there was a great deal of concern that he would renege on that promise. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing that he was about to do, and so African Americans were just not quite sure that it was going to happen. And of course, as the day wore on, they became more and more concerned about if it actually would happen or not.
Do it. Put the pen to paper. Your co-author in the book, Harold Holzer, who helps bring this wonderful collection of depictions of the signing and the kind of almost deification of Lincoln in that moment in many of these pictures. But he writes that the Emancipation Proclamation originally struck many critics as radical, divisive, and dangerous. More recently has been assailed by skeptics as timid, conservative, and deceptive. Can you help us understand each of those in its day, seen as radical, divisive, and dangerous? Why? And then what about the more skeptical later interpretation?
Certainly it was considered radical for that period, because he was liberating property without the consent of the owner and without compensation. And those were two things that Lincoln always wanted. He wanted slavery to end, but he wanted it to end gradually. And he wanted it to end with the consent of the owner and with compensation. And, of course, none of that happened with the Emancipation Proclamation. So it definitely was considered radical in that regard. It was divisive because there were great numbers of people in the North who were not abolitionist. And, you know, the abolitionists had this kind of people had the kind of view of abolitionists that they themselves were radical and that they were divisive. Mm-hmm. And there were people who were more than willing to allow the South to continue having its slaves and if they would return to the Union. And even there were those abolitionists who thought that when the South seceded from the Union, then the whole issue of abolition was over. Didn't matter that there were still people enslaved, but that these slaveholders and enslaved people were no longer in the country, in their country. So they were more than satisfied. And your last part was, I believe, about the attitude of historians now about Lincoln.
Well, there
and
have
whether
been.
Or not
I mean, as Harold Holzer reminds us, skeptics looking back on it and calling it timid, conservative, even deceptive. Why?
It's because he uses the concept of military necessity. He doesn't do it for humanity. At least he doesn't do it for stated humanitarian reasons. Mm-hmm. He does it, he says, out of military necessity. That's certainly language that he has to use because he's using the War Powers Clause of the Constitution. And that clause says that in times of war, the president as commander-in-chief has the authority to seize and or destroy property that belongs to the enemy or to the friend as long as it furthers the cause of the nation. And so he had to say this was out of military necessity. People would have liked, would have loved if it was done for humanitarian reasons, but of course it could not be. Now, does that mean that Lincoln did not consider this humanitarian? He absolutely did. I mean, he understood. He hated slavery. I think most historians would agree that he hated slavery. He wanted it to end. His idea, though, for ending it was gradual. He was more than willing to sort of wait it out. And so he did it in he wanted it done in terms of containment. You know, let it die out. Let it die a natural death in the South. Let it not spread into the territories, however. And so I think that We tend to feel that it was not that radical because he doesn't do it for humanitarian reasons. But of course, he was not able to do that because of the constraints of the Constitution.
Let's take a call from Lansing, Michigan. Ken, you're on the air. Hi, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I just really wanted to comment in a reference to growing up in the South Bronx and my family having Mr. President Lincoln on our wall.
You did, indeed.
Actually, you know, we did not, but he was a very focal point in being recognized, growing up and going to school. He was actually known throughout our community for his contributions and the things that he has done. Also, for us, the way we look at Mr. Lincoln was in reverence to, like, Martin Luther King, someone that was a champion for our cause, someone that brought hope to our community. And that's why I think it's fitting that President-elect Obama is going to be sworn in with his Bible and just symbolizing the contributions that President Lincoln's done. Now this new transition that's coming to take place. And it just really, for me personally, symbolized hope and the change that now our country has evolved to. So I really wanted to just comment on that because although African-Americans, the significance that, you know, President Lincoln has done, if you do a poll, most African-Americans know about President Lincoln and what he has done to better our race.
So you second Obama's reverence for President Lincoln. You're on board with it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that if you going back and looking at history and what President Lincoln has done and what he tried to do and freeing us, and I've actually come from a family of slaves. My great grandmother was one, and just giving us that opportunity to say, "Hey, we're now included in this great America that we always hoped it could be," and that's the same sentiments that Dr. Martin Luther King had also spoke about.
Ken, thank you very much for that. Edna Greene Medford, it's hardly surprising that Abraham Lincoln would be respected. But you and others have written about how African-American attitude toward Lincoln has sort of had an ebb and flow over the years. Very, very high in the Civil War and immediately afterward, but not so well a few decades after the end of that war.
That's true. I think it's because of how African Americans perceived the proclamation. They understood that it was releasing them from slavery, but they also thought that it was about full freedom, full citizenship. And that's not what happened in the post-war years. So by the 20th century, even earlier than that, you have some African Americans questioning what the proclamation was really for. You have some leaders who are actually using Lincoln's memory to support this whole thrust for African American rights. But you have some African Americans who are questioning where the race is as we look at the larger population of Americans. They are suffering enormously in the period after the war, and certainly by the time of the Depression, when you have those narratives from former slaves, some of them are saying slavery was so much better than these times. Lincoln must have had a lot of faith in black people to give them nothing but freedom.
Right.
You know, there was no economic independence.
No 40 acres and a mule, it turned out.
Absolutely. And of course, by the time of the Civil Rights Movement, you have African American heroes. So it's not so much that Lincoln is disliked as it is that there are other people who are replacing him in the pantheon of heroes for African Americans.
Let's take a call from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, into Bert. Bert, you're on the air.
Well, I think you made an important point there. The guest made an important point. Military necessity, commander in chief. It seems to me that, you know, I was taught in elementary school that the Civil War was fought to free the slaves. That is clearly not true. The Emancipation Proclamation, correct me if I'm wrong, was a military necessity to destroy the economy of the South, to take away the property and to completely destroy the economy. It was a military necessity. I think you're right that the guest is saying it wasn't about equality and freedom, and many, many other Western nations did free the enslaved people without a civil war. But this was about keeping the power of the central government and using the freeing of the enslaved people within the enemy territory just as a military tactic to destroy the economy.
Bert, let us go down exactly that road, and thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, how about it? Military necessity above all here, or a kind of march of history bigger than that in effect? Both?
Both, and you know, the document does speak of what it calls this, quote, an act of justice. So that word is in there. And at a stroke, the emancipation transformed what had been a civil war, a war to restore a union, into a revolutionary war. This was a war against the very foundation of the Southern way of life. And how deep the foundation went may be gauged by the fact that in the state of Alabama, an estimated 45% of all white people drove their income one way or another from slavery. So to attack slavery was to be, it was revolutionary. It was going right at the root. And quickly people saw that it wasn't just a matter of military necessity. Horace Greeley, writing in the New York Tribune, called this one of the most stupendous facts in human history, and he said the emancipation marks not only an era in the progress of the nation, but an epoch in the history of the world. Yes, the short-run goal was to sort of have a deep strike behind rebel lines and to revolutionize the war and also to neutralize European opinion. And to sort of back Britain off any thought of recognizing the Confederacy, but it also had, as people saw right at the time, this call for justice and this vision of emancipation as an epoch in the history of the world.
Let me get a call from Bruce in Shoreham, Vermont. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. There were just a couple of points I wanted to make. One, that your guest just made, that one of Lincoln's motivations was to keep Great Britain out of the war on the side of the South. And another effect of this was a motivating factor for many, not all, but certainly many Northern soldiers. And it's also, I think, important to note that it was issued in September of the year before, and there was a 100-day period for any places that would be affected by the Emancipation Proclamation to switch back to the Union side and thus not be affected by the Emancipation Proclamation and lose their property.
Bruce, thanks for that. Edna Greene Medford, what about, first of all, how Europe and Great Britain looked on this? But also, Bruce brings up the morale of Union soldiers, and reading in your work here, it seems it had a kind of complex effect on that, not hardly uniform, and for some, negative.
Absolutely. In terms of the reaction of European nations to the proclamation, we have to distinguish between the European governments and European people. For instance, the English thought he had lost his mind. They
Why?
Were very concerned about it. Just the idea, you know, everyone assumed that there was going to be this great revolution of enslaved people, that when he issued the proclamation, there would be a lot of burning and raping and pillaging and so forth.
Sort of like Haiti back in history.
Yes, it would give the slaves license to destroy mm-hmm. the South. Mm-hmm. And so you have that perspective, but you also have the British government concerned about the trade relationship between the southern states and between them. Cotton was necessary for their textile mills, mm-hmm. of course. And the Union Army was blockading the coastline and preventing that kind of trade, or at least reducing it to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So the government had a very negative reaction initially. The English people, however, thought it was marvelous because they were wedded to a free labor system. So we really do have to distinguish between the two. In terms of the reaction of the Union soldiers, there were mixed reactions, absolutely. There were some who were delighted that this war was now won not just for preservation of the Union, but for freedom for black people as well. But there were other soldiers who said they did not sign up to fight this war to free Negroes, and they did not always use the term Negroes. Mm-hmm. And so there were men, it's been reported that there were men in the field in some areas, especially in the Midwestern groups, that threw down their guns. There were a few incidents of that kind of thing occurring. So by no means was the Emancipation Proclamation something that was embraced by all Northerners.
How important had the slave population itself been to the Southern war effort, the Southern war machine, in terms of the infrastructure of production behind the lines?
Absolutely essential. African Americans continued to work in the same capacity that they had before secession. They were still working in the fields. They were still working in munitions factories, for instance. They are working, setting up breastworks, throwing up breastworks for the Confederate Army. They're serving as orderlies and teamsters. They're doing any number of things that make it very good for the Confederacy. The Confederacy was doing very well for a long period of time with mm-hmm. this war. And that slave labor force was crucial to them. And Lincoln understood how crucial they were and realized that he needed to do something to throw the South into chaos. Now, certainly we need to remember that long before the proclamation, African Americans are making their way to Union lines. Mm-hmm. But when the proclamation is issued, I love a comment that the editor of the Anglo-African made in 1863. He said, "The proclamation was like a pillar of flame beckoning the slaves to the dreamed of promise of freedom." And that is absolutely what it does.
We'll come back and look at exactly what that meant for Union forces and Civil War history. Edna Greene Medford, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Emancipation Proclamation, signed January 1st, 1863, and its resonance in January 2009 as the country prepares for the inauguration of Barack Obama. Edna Greene Medford joins us from Howard University, co-author of the Emancipation Proclamation, Three Views, wonderful book of essays and illustrations on that great act and from that time. Jack Beatty is here as well, author of Age of Betrayal. You can join us. What did you learn in school, at home, about the Emancipation Proclamation? Is Obama still a piece of the emancipation story? And when he puts his hand on Lincoln's Bible to take the oath of office this month, is the circle somehow complete? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's get a call from Needham, Massachusetts, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm listening with great interest in this, and it's been on two points I'd like to make. One, I was amazed at the incredible 180-degree turn that I think Lincoln made from a young attorney in Illinois who was pretty much ambivalent about the race question. And then later on, as the war progresses, he's talking about the possibility of freeing the slaves and then sending, providing federal monies to send everybody back to various countries, you know, African countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mantle of the presidency, I think, as well as political necessity, came upon him, and he came to the point of saying, you know, slavery is basically a moral bad thing, and let's dispose of that. Now, as a Midwestern person growing up in the 1940s, I had the mantle of racism upon me from my community, my neighborhood, my
mm-hmm.
schools,
mm-hmm.
and my point of reversal came. I was made a member of the New Hampshire delegation to Martin Luther King's funeral in 1968,
mm-hmm.
and the airplanes were met in Atlanta by folk who were very loving and good to us, and I could begin washing away the last vestiges of racism in myself. And I think that's a dilemma with people, particularly over the age of 50 or 60, that our community involvement as children put that upon us. And that was my experience. I think much as Lincoln's experience was the mantle of the presidency and the circumstances of the conflict that forced him to make a move, which was politically very awkward because the border states were going to go against him. You couldn't selectively emancipate slaves. He kind of knew that once you started this going, it would be a deluge, that
mm-hmm.
all slaves would see themselves as emancipated. And that would be my comment, sir.
David, it's a wonderful comment and testimony in a way, and I appreciate it. Thank you for calling. Edna, could we go first to Lincoln's own evolution, which David points to, mm-hmm. in his own racial attitudes, from his, you know, coming up and time as a lawyer in Illinois to the moment when he was signing that document, as Jack Beatty described it. What about his evolution on race?
He certainly did evolve substantially. The one incident that we think of most when we think of Lincoln in a negative light in terms of his racial views is the Charleston debate. In 1858, one of the seven debates that he was involved in with the senatorial incumbent, Stephen A. Douglas,
mm-hmm.
Lincoln was running against him for the Senate seat
mm-hmm.
from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes some very racially charged comments there, and he talks about the inequality of African Americans, and he says that, you know, people are equal in terms of their right to enjoy the fruits of their labor, but they are not necessarily equal in social ways, intellectually, or
mm-hmm.
politically.
Mm-hmm.
And he, for one, preferred to be on the winning side of that, and that was on the side of the white race. What's interesting, however, is by April 11th of 1865, when he makes his last public address, he suggests, he does more than suggest, he says that he would like to see the elective franchise given to certain segments of the African American community, the more intelligent, he says, and
mm-hmm.
those who served the nation as soldiers during the war. Now, that more intelligent part always
mm-hmm.
bothers me
mm-hmm.
because there are lots of non-blacks who are voting who are not terribly well-educated
sure.
or not educated
mm-hmm.
at all,
mm-hmm.
and no one's really questioning that. But for him to even suggest that a segment of the African American population should have political rights, that's pretty extraordinary for those times. So he does evolve significantly in that regard. How much further he would have gone, I don't know. I think, though, that we need to look at his presidency and see how cautious he was. And I think he would have been cautious in that regard as well. He's making suggestions to Louisiana fairly early on when Louisiana is trying to reconstruct its government. This is before the war is over. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, I make the suggestion that you consider this, but it's just a suggestion. Certainly by 1865, he was a little bit stronger in his position.
But in the run-up to signing the emancipation, in the autumn, as I read here, I think, in the autumn of 1862, he was still suggesting to African Americans that they leave the United States on the other side of emancipation, for Africa or South America out.
Mm-hmm.
That hardly sounds like a ringing endorsement of throwing America's arms around newly freed citizens.
Right, and the argument has been made that he's preparing the nation for emancipation, that he's saying to the South, you see what I'm doing? I'm showing you that you can free your slaves and not necessarily have African Americans in your presence afterwards. You can encourage them to leave the country. Because there are people who are holding slaves, certainly not just because it's an economic advantage to them, but they're doing it for social reasons as well. Every enslaved African American elevates every white person, whether they are slaveholders or not. And Lincoln understands the significance of that to the American people.
Elevates them by their existence as a lower class, as the first rung.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Makes them feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. And so Lincoln understands that. He understands that some Southerners are against emancipation because they don't want to have free African Americans within their midst. So he's giving them this. He's saying, you see, this is possible. And the argument has been made he wasn't really serious about it. I think he was. Lincoln, certainly, his first and foremost concern was preservation of the Union. That doesn't mean that he didn't care about slavery, that he didn't want slavery to end, but he certainly was willing to compromise with that peace if he could preserve the Union in some other way, and he says so. He says so in the letter to Horace Greeley, and I, for one, believe that, that's exactly what he meant. Does it mean that he would not have continued to work for African-American freedom after the nation was reunited? Mm-hmm. I believe he would have continued doing that, but under the constraints of the Constitution, within the boundaries of the Constitution, he would have been.
Of course, he did not live for us to know that. Jack, let me get one call,
exactly,
if I may, quickly here from Saudi Arabia, no less, and Ibrahim. Ibrahim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm an African American, and I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, during the 50s and 60s. So I'm a little bit a witness of the Jim Crow era, which was some of a backlash of the freedom of Black Americans.
Certainly.
And I was wondering about the comment that was made earlier in the program where one of your guests mentioned that President Lincoln, who I was taught was the freer of slaves during Emancipation Proclamation. But I was wondering what the impact may have been, if there's been any speculation, had Lincoln gotten his way for gradual decreasing of slavery. And I'll take my answer off there.
Edna, can you respond to that?
Yeah. Historians don't like to speculate, but let me try to.
But Ibrahim's reference also to a gradual diminution.
Yes.
You mentioned that earlier yourself, and I'm not sure
I
totally understand what that meant or might mean.
Lincoln believed that if slaves were manumitted, were emancipated immediately, it would be a hardship, not just for the slaveholder, but for enslaved people as well, that people had to gradually work their way out of the old relationship between master and slave, so to speak. And so he preferred a more long-term removal of slavery. That's why he talked about the whole idea of containment. Don't allow slavery to spread any further than it already is. Don't let it come into the territories because eventually it's going to die a natural death.
But what did he mean by that? Many years? Decades? I mean, how long did he state? How long he'd been willing to tolerate slavery?
Well, let me give you an example. In the first year of the war, he understood fairly early on that slavery was the cause of the war, mm-hmm. that this whole issue of expansion versus letting the South go, you know, keeping it contained within mm-hmm. the South was the whole difference between the North and the South. And so what he was suggesting to Delaware is a state that had fewer than 2,000 enslaved people. It was a border state. Lincoln is trying to get them to voluntarily release their slaves. But he gives them two plans. One would have ended slavery over a gradual period, but ended slavery in Delaware in 1867. Mm-hmm. His second plan was suggesting that they could do a more gradual movement toward the end of slavery. And so you would have some segments of the African-American population still enslaved as late as the 1890s wow. and beyond.
Wow.
So certainly he was willing to sort of have a whole nother generation of African-Americans continue in slavery, if that would help to preserve the Union.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of Abraham Lincoln's evolution on race? And this sense that slavery could go on potentially even for decades if it would have preserved the Union. War, the exigencies of war make many things happen. In this case, that signing you talked about, but the 1890s would have seemed an awfully long way off for someone in chains.
Yes, and as Professor Medford knows, Stanley Engerman in the 1970s wrote a book, Time on the Cross, about essentially he thought that slavery was more efficient than people had ever imagined, that the African-American workforce was extraordinarily efficient, and that this institution could have putted on right into the 20th century, that there was a kind of momentum to it. After all, if you were to work it out, slavery involved what would today be almost $10 trillion of our economy. That's how big it was. So, it had a dreadful economic momentum and could have gone on. Lincoln also, of course, toyed with the idea of compensated emancipation. And he pointed out, and when you think of it this way, it really brings home the horror of the war and the gratuitous nature of the suffering, that 3 months of expenditure on the war could have purchased all of the slaves. 3 months.
Wow.
But his evolution really was that of the countries. Yes, you had abolitionists, but Frederick Douglass even said that among the abolitionists you found racist attitudes. No one had come over really. I mean, maybe Wendell Phillips or people like that, but very few other men and women had come over on the race issue. The idea of equality was still almost impossible for Americans to grasp. And you know, as we mm-hmm. approach Barack Obama's inauguration, it still remains difficult for some Americans. But I really think that the change in the idea of equality is the great contribution of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. That really was the new birth of freedom in America.
Let me get a call from Carl in West Hartford, Connecticut. Our time is short, but hi, Carl, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment about the fact that, yeah, I think we have come a long way, and I think that a lot of African-Americans are aware that the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't really and truly meant just to serve us as far as freeing slaves. And the sad part is, even till this day, I think there's a certain kind of slave mentality that still takes place amongst a lot of African-Americans throughout the generations. I mean, I could remember many, many, many things being said by my great-grandmother that almost didn't make any sense. There was a fear and a superstition about whites as far as what they could possibly do to blacks. And I got to tell you that I actually grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
and I am telling you, even to this day, I was there recently, and a huge gap in education amongst the young blacks in the Deep South to this very day is very significant and very serious. I agree with the historian there who stated the fact that economically, blacks weren't ever given anything. Mm-hmm. We never got our 40 acres and a mule.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, economically, till this very day, there is still a huge disparity that I have to work hard to leave my children something that was handed to a tremendous amount of people that we never took part in. and we did help to invent, we did help to build, we did help to give to whites. Even Frederick Douglass wrote about the fact that even after the Civil War, blacks were like children to their masters. And this mentality has carried on for a very, very long time in this country.
Carl, we've got it, and the clock ticks mercilessly down on us here, but it's a fascinating perspective that you bring there, and I appreciate it. Edna Greene Medford, how about it? Looking at the history that you know so well in light of the inauguration that will take place this month of an African-American, though not descended from slaves, Barack Obama, how does it reflect back? How does it resonate off the history you know around the Emancipation Proclamation, this inauguration?
It's a major step forward in terms of full inclusion. It's absolutely extraordinary. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I'm afraid that I'm going to wake up and realize it was all a dream.
Right.
But I would caution us as a nation to recognize that this was an extraordinary movement forward, but it doesn't mean that we're there. It doesn't mean that there's full inclusion. It means that we did the smart thing as a nation. We did the right thing as a nation. We elected someone that the nation has tremendous faith in. It's one person's personal achievement, but achieved through the work of a variety of people in this country. But that's about inclusion, and that's what African Americans believed the proclamation was as well. But just because we have made this extraordinary step does not mean that we're there, that we have done everything that the enslaved people thought the proclamation was about. There will still be poverty. There will still be racism and discrimination in this country. We now need to work on those things. And I hope that the election of Mr. Obama will really inspire us to go even beyond where we are, because we can be a great nation if we can do that.
Edna Greene Medford of Howard University, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Barack Obama's inauguration kicks off the Lincoln Memorial later this month, where, of course, Lincoln's statue and Martin Luther King stood. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us this hour, and Happy New Year, Jack.
Happy New Year to you.
We'll go out with No More Auction Block for me, from Odetta, who just died this past year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
No more auction block for